It's a song we all know. It's a riff we can all play. It's on an album that many of us own. But do you know the story behind the song? Today on The Vinyl Guide, we'll explore the legend of one of the most famous songs in music history and speak to people who were there. Today on The Vinyl Guide, we're diving into the Deep Purple album Machine Head and the mega hit Smoke on the Water. And it's thanks to show sponsors Thorne's Turntables. Hear your records at their clearest. Ask your hi-fi dealer about a Thorne's turntable today. And we're also sponsored by GrooveWasher.com. Keep your records clean and sounding their best with a GrooveWasher record cleaning system available from GrooveWasher.com. And with that, let's start today's episode.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hey everyone, welcome to yet another episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. Glad you could all make it. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to everyone who's been sharing these episodes and links to these episodes on social media with their friends, etc. Look, the Vinyl Guide community, it just continues to grow. It's really quite impressive, the dedication many of you have for this podcast. Those of you who are just listening for the first time, welcome. I hope you enjoy our discussions on all things music and vinyl record related. We have a big back catalog of episodes with commentary and interviews from some of the music history makers, the musicians, the engineers, the people who've been around music and vinyl record history as it was being made. Last week's episode, we had Wayne Kramer of the MC5 who joined us for a great discussion regarding their LPs and deep dive into the groundbreaking album Kick Out the Jam. So a lot of great feedback on that episode. So if you haven't heard it, please circle back and check it out. And if you enjoy this podcast and are currently listening to it through a web browser, make sure you subscribe. It's totally free, and it'll make sure you never miss an episode. They'll automatically download to your iPhone or your Android device or whatever. You could listen to it in the car or while you're out for a walk or while you're on the go somehow. And if you want to do that, there's links on our website that'll show you how. Go to www.thevinylguide.com. There's links along the left-hand side if you got an iPhone or an Android device, or if you happen to know what an RSS reader is, it has that information there too. If you're new to podcasting, conceptually, and the technology is a bit confusing, we have a section on the website called Help with Podcasts that'll walk you through exactly how to do that. And to those of you with an iTunes account, please log in and leave us a positive iTunes review. That's a huge help to us. Definitely want to say thank you to Stardrum, Jab3223, Seahawk, Trent Brown, Geeky Girl 4. You guys recently left some great reviews on iTunes. I really do appreciate it. To the rest of you guys out there who haven't done it yet, please, that is one thing that we ask for. We don't ask for much, but that is one thing that'll help extend The Vinyl Guide beyond its current community. So how to do that? Go to www.thevinylguide.com. Again, along the left, there's an iTunes link that'll take you right there. Leave us a 5-star review, say something nice, and hopefully it'll extend to others. But that is a huge favor to me. It helps extend the work that I put into this podcast for others to hear about and then enjoy. Today on The Vinyl Guide, we are taking a deep dive into one of history's most popular songs, Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple from their album Machine Head. Now, I know everyone out there knows the song, but do you know the story behind it? It's a pretty fascinating tale, so hang in there. I think everyone will enjoy our talk on the occurrences that led up to the recording of the song, plus the subsequent activities that made it a hit song and propelled the album Machine Head to become a worldwide hit for the band. Plus, we'll continue to talk about records, first pressings, what to look for in the Deep Purple Machine Head albums and the Deep Purple universe. I think you all will enjoy this discussion. All that on today's show, plus a quick chat on the new Pink Floyd box set. So we'll get right into it after we pay some bills with our fabulous sponsors, Thorne's Turntables and GrooveWasher.com. The one thing that all record collectors and vinyl enthusiasts have in common are turntables. However, not all turntables are created equal. Do you know that More and more used record stores are starting to warn their customers against those cheapy turntables. Look, it's because cheap turntables can ruin records. And when you invest in records, you want them to last as long as possible and sound as brilliant as possible. And that's why you need a Thorens turntable. Thorens turntables are designed and manufactured in Switzerland and Germany. Wonderful engineering with the sole purpose of ensuring high quality sound. The Thorens has turntables for just about any budget, so don't think you need to spend thousands and thousands of dollars. Thorens has a full line of great sounding turntables that will fit into any budget. So check for yourself. Go to Thorens.com, Thorens.com. Check them out for yourselves, read the specs, or ask your hi-fi dealer today. Thorens turntables, quality which you can hear. Another day, another record being played. But how is the audio quality of your record? If you want to maximize your sound, you need to make sure your record is clean and free of debris and dust. And to do this, I use the Groove Washer record cleaning system. The Groove Washer system uses a special G2 fluid, which loosens up the hidden dirt inside the grooves and enables vinyl playback to be at its best. And the Groove Washer record cleaning system is a fraction of what those expensive record machines cost. You can get a Groove Washer record cleaning system today for less than $50 at groovewasher.com. Now, this is what I use at home, and this is what I recommend for the vinyl hobbyist. Head over to groovewasher.com to get yours today. That's groovewasher.com, and they are made in the USA. It's a riff we all know. It's simple, and just about anyone can play it on a musical instrument. It's one of the most popular songs in the history of rock and roll music and played a central role in the formation of the heavy metal music genre. It's a song known around the world, covered by bands in dozens, possibly hundreds of languages. Wherever you're at, either in a concert hall in North America or a smoky club in Taipei, people will recognize this song the moment they hear it. Of course, we're talking about Smoke on the Water, the 1972 track from Deep Purple from their album Machine Head, which became their signature song and defining career moment. The album Machine Head represents the band at their peak, setting a foundation for reported sales of over 100 million LPs across the band's catalog. But do you know the story of the song? Well, you should. It's told in the lyrics without a lot of need for interpretation. But before we go there, let's take a quick look backwards. Prior to 1972, Deep Purple was just another hard-working blues rock band from the UK. Originally formed in 1968, Deep Purple started out as the brainchild of the UK drummer Chris Curtis, who convinced a local UK businessman, Tony Edwards, to form a rotating supergroup. Members could come and go, enter, and eventually exit, just like a traffic roundabout. In fact, that is the exact name they chose for the project, Roundabout. Ironically, though, even the managers were part of this roundabout, and soon Chris Curtis was dismissed from the project, which continued on. So in forming this project, musicians were considered, discussed, and eventually an initial lineup was semi-solidified, featuring the following. Ritchie Blackmore on guitar, John Lord on organ, Ian Paice on drums, alongside Nick Simper on bass, and Rod Evans on vocals. And the band changed their name to Deep Purple, after a song that Ritchie Blackmore's grandmother named as her favorite.
When the deep purple falls over sleepy garden walls and the stars begin
quite an auspicious start for what became one of the world's defining heavy metal bands. Moving forward, this lineup of Deep Purple became known as the Mach 1 lineup and recorded three albums: Deep Purple, Shades of Deep Purple, and The Book of Taliesin, after which the band continued to struggle to find their fan base. Their U.S. record company, Tetragrammaton Records, a venture founded by comedian Bill Cosby and his manager, was floundering, leaving Deep Purple with crippled representation and little direction in what is arguably the world's biggest market for rock music. During that time of confusion, Blackmore, Lord, and Pace decided it was time to revisit the direction of the band and agreed they shared a common interest in moving towards a heavier sound. And with that decision made, it was agreed that both Simper and Evans had to go, and the search for a new bassist and vocalist began in earnest. And to fill those key positions, Deep Purple had to look no further than the band Episode 6. Episode 6 was a psychedelic pop band from London, high on perseverance but low on hits. Playing across England and sporadic residencies in Europe and cutting roughly a dozen singles in the mid-60s with none of them catching on beyond nominal play. This understandably frustrated the musicians, who began rotating in and out of the lineup. Episode 6 vocalist was the fiery-voiced Ian Gillan, who attracted the attention of the remaining members of Deep Purple. When asked to demo some new recordings, Ian Gillan came through along with bassist Roger Glover, who subbed in as a bass player to fill in the void. Pleased with the results, Blackmore, Lord, and Pace offered Gillan the vocal job and Glover the available bass position. And with that, the legendary lineup of Deep Purple Mach 2 was born. To generate publicity, Deep Purple dived into a project that was very different than their intended direction. Concerto for Group and Orchestra is an album featuring Deep Purple playing alongside the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, a rare combination of rock and classical music. The score was written by John Lord, and while the original concert contained a few Deep Purple hits of the day, the finished record held only the concerto tracks, combining the classical musicianship with the accompaniment of a budding heavy metal band. That unique combination seemed to get the attention of the public, and the album, Concerto for Group and Orchestra, sold reasonably well. However, not to be pigeonholed as a bit of a gimmick, the band soon got to work on their next album, In Rock, showcasing a much heavier sound than they'd previously shared. In Rock showed Deep Purple as a band coming together, developing a style similar to other popular bands like Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin. So Deep Purple were rewarded with their efforts with a top five album. And not willing to rest on their laurels, the following year they released Fireball, another impressive heavy effort. Those releases, along with their dedication to tour endlessly, continued to build their profile and fan base. However, in late 1971, the band had a three-week break in their touring schedule and were keen to use that time to record the next album. They had several tracks they'd been working on the road and a few empty spots they knew they needed to fill in the studio, nothing they hadn't done before. All they needed was a location to record, and their friend, a gentleman by the name of Claude Nobbs, had just the suggestion. The Casino Concert Hall in Montreux, Switzerland, sat on the shoreline of Lake Geneva. It was built in 1881 and had seen its share of modifications and remodeling over the years. In the early part of the 20th century, the Casino Concert Hall laid host to symphonic performances with world-famous conductors and musicians. And by the 1960s, the facilities were beginning to experience performances in jazz, blues, and rock bands. The Montreux Casino became the location for the Montreux Jazz Festival, under the management of Claude Nobbs. When Deep Purple needed a place to record, Claude suggested recording in the Casino Hall. He was aware of a three-week break from the bookings, which would provide an ideal environment for Deep Purple to rehearse and belt out the tracks they'd been working on while touring. All they needed was a recording truck, which they dutifully rented from the Rolling Stones. So, with all the plans made and the facility secured, Deep Purple rolled into town the evening of December 3rd, 1971, to prepare for taking over the Montreux Casino after the hall hosted one final concert. Frank Zappa and the Mothers were scheduled to play a matinee show on the following day. On December 4th, 1971, Frank Zappa and his band, the Mothers of Invention, were playing a matinee set at the Montreux Casino Hall on Lake Geneva. Zappa's band was in the middle of their track King Kong from the album Uncle Meat when keyboardist Don Preston, in the middle of his Moog solo, looked up and saw something odd.
We played in a concert hall. It just so happened that the ceiling of the hall was covered with dried palm leaves.
That's Don Preston, keyboard player for Frank Zappa's band during this era and this particular show in Montreux.
King Kong, in the middle of my solo, and somebody threw a firecracker up in the air, and it exploded, and the ceiling caught on fire. That's when, and I saw the guy throw a firecracker up, so whatever they thought, not really correct.
So it sounds as if the rumored line, "some stupid with a flare gun," may have actually been a firework or possibly a Roman candle or something like that. But whatever the case, the Montreux Casino Hall began to catch fire.
And so and I remember Mark Volman bent over to pick up his brand new Gibson hollow body guitar, and somebody's foot went right through it before he was able to grab it.
Now, what I'm about to play for you is an audio recording of those moments. It's not the greatest quality, but it's all we have. So if you listen, you'll hear the band play, you'll hear the mini Moog solo start, and then, after a few moments, it will stop. If you listen closely, you'll hear Mark Volman yell the word fire, and hear Frank make an announcement for the audience to leave the building, followed by the general movement of people fleeing the burning building. It was a very scary moment, and it's incredible that in the end, nobody died. The theater had an estimated 2,500 people inside, which was beyond capacity, And there were even people outside who weren't able to get in, but they were a blockage for the exits. And to make sure that none of these additional people rushed into the doors, the additional emergency exits were chained closed. So when the fire broke out, there were only two functioning exits. The front door, which supported only a few people exiting at a given time, and a plate glass window with a reported 10 to 15 foot drop. So how did people escape the concert hall?
Everybody was running out. People were picking up orange amplifiers and throwing them through these big, huge plate glass windows that were... Now, this was in the afternoon. We were playing a concert in the afternoon, so it wasn't dark or anything.
Roadies and concertgoers quickly threw amplifiers through the windows, which allowed the majority of concertgoers to escape. Remarkably, everyone exited calmly, and there were only a few injuries reported. We may have reason to thank Claude Knobs for that. Besides being the promoter and the booker of the venue, he was also a volunteer fireman, and he was on hand to help manage the evacuation. This again was immortalized in the Deep Purple song as Funky Claude was running in and out, pulling kids out the ground. When it all was over, Deep Purple had to find another place. And they did. Claude Knobs again set them up at a location called the Pavilion. However, very quickly the sound of the instruments brought noise complaints, and the band, alongside engineer Martin Birch, were only able to record the backing tracks for the song that became Smoke on the Water, literally with the police at the door asking them to stop. And with the band's visas expiring and the rental costs of the Rolling Stones' mobile truck continuing, they finally settled on a location called the Montreux Grand Hotel, which again was a dilapidated building. The band had to set up their gear in abandoned stairwells and sleep on mattresses on the floor in order to get the recordings done with the remaining time allowed. In fact, this part of the experience is also cataloged in the song in the last verse. When you hear the sequence of events, it's clear that the song Smoke on the Water was pieced together in the weeks after the fire. The lyrics were biographical and credited to Roger Glover, and the title, Smoke on the Water, was Glover's description of watching the fire from his hotel room and seeing the smoke across Lake Geneva.
Our hotel was on Lake Geneva as well as this venue. And that's why the title of the song is Smoke on the Water, because from our hotel, we could see the club burning down. I mean, and the smoke was on the water. And we had to look across the lake. And there it was, the smoke on the water.
When their album was finished, an LP titled Machine Head, the band respectfully dedicated it to Claude Knobs and even features his picture in the gatefold sleeve, affording him the same stature as each of the band members. And the song Smoke on the Water, clearly an acknowledgement to Claude Knobs, not only for his friendship and dedication and helping the band overcome all these issues, as well as his bravery and quick thinking that likely saved hundreds of lives. Weeks after the song was recorded, the band played it to Claude. Deep Purple thought it was a bit of a filler song. They originally didn't see much potential for it. In fact, the focus of the Machine Head album was a song called Never Before, which the band was convinced was going to be their hit breakthrough single. And indeed, it was the first single off the record, but it fizzled out pretty quick. Deep Purple continued to release several other tracks as singles with very limited success. The song Never Before, then Highway Star, even the boogie tune Lazy were all released as singles and failed to make much of a dent in album sales. Once again, Claude Knobs came to the rescue and recommended that they put forward Smoke on the Water as a single. Claude absolutely loved the riff, and he didn't understand why the band didn't. But luckily, the band continued to listen to Claude, gave the song a push, and radio stations took it from there. Smoke on the Water quickly became a nationwide hit in America, vaulting the year-old Machine Head album into the top five in the US and Canada. Millions of teenagers with cheap guitars found they could successfully play the riff with minimal issues, and the song found itself on the set list of every garage, bar, and party band across the world. It was a bit late for a hit, though. Deep Purple had already started to implode. By the time Smoke on the Water was catching on around the world, Ian Gillan and Roger Glover had already left the band, and the remaining members pulled in Glenn Hughes and David Coverdale to fill their spots. Good efforts, but it just wasn't the same, and Deep Purple moved forward, but never duplicated the success of Machine Head, nor had an anthem that ever came close to Smoke on the Water. Okay, now for you record nerds, here's what you need to know. Now, we spoke about several Deep Purple records today. Let's start first with the obvious Machine Head album. The first pressing is the 1972 release in the UK on Purple Records, catalog number TPSA 7504. Purple Records is a record label set up by Deep Purple's management and stayed relatively active until 1979, releasing a few hundred records, the majority of which were Deep Purple related. The Purple Records record label is purple, try saying that 10 times, with the white letter P coming from the lower side of the label. It reminds me a bit of the Pickwick record label, if you remember those. This original version came with a fold-out poster of the lyrics. In the US, the first pressing of Machine Head in 1972 was on the Warner Brothers Green label. However, the subsequent year, Warner switched to the Burbank record label. This is when the song Smoke on the Water became a radio mainstay, so there are a heap of copies of the Burbank record label out there. One thing, though, most of those Green label copies and the early Burbank label copies of Machine Head are really beat up. I have a hard time finding those old copies in good condition. These records were well loved. This was a party album, so a lot of these records seem to have traveled around a bit, been well played and well enjoyed. And that's really quite nice. I like it when that happens. Another Deep Purple to keep an eye out for is the LP Concerto for Group and Orchestra. There's a real collectible out there in the original U.S. pressing. Remember we spoke about the Tetragrammaton record label, the one started by Bill Cosby and his management? Well, the Deep Purple Concerto album was the very last record pressed by that label. And by that time, the label was really disorganized. The one to look for is catalog number T131. It's the final release of the Tetragrammaton record label, and by the time they got to that, they were clearly cutting corners. It's a bit of a ramshot effort, but now it's worth around $100 just for the cruel story attached to it. The recording was re-released by Warner Brothers the following year on the Green record label, which could be had for $5 or $10 at any swap meet around. So that's the story of Deep Purple, Frank Zappa, Claude Knobs, Machine Head, the Montreux Casino Fire, and the song Smoke on the Water. And despite the challenges and the events that occurred, the stars lined up perfectly for them at this one point in history. Deep Purple recorded an album which is a true ass-kicker in the real sense of the word, and a song which will live in infamy, greatly assisted by the fact that just about anyone can learn to play it on guitar. Almost anyone. All right, before we wrap up today's episode of The Vinyl Guide, really quick, I wanted to address something that a lot of listeners have emailed me about and pinged me about regarding the announcement that Pink Floyd recently made about their upcoming box set, Pink Floyd the Early Years, 1965 to 1972. Now, some of you may recall about a year ago, I went on a bit of a rant regarding Roger Waters' The Wall Live Super Deluxe box set, in which Roger Waters was selling a box set that contained four LPs, I think two or three Blu-ray discs, and a DVD for $550, something like that. I can't recall exactly how much it was, but it was high. And by the way, I wasn't the only one complaining. There was a heap of backlash online. Even on Roger's own Facebook page, diehard, lifelong Roger Waters fans were outraged that he was asking $550 plus shipping for a box set that just contained those items. So I went on a bit of a rant. Wasn't my finest hour. You could always go back and listen to it, but there it was. I still stick to those words. I do think that package was a bit of an overstep for Roger. And so a lot of folks, now that Pink Floyd has announced their own box set, which apparently is retailing for more than $550, I think it's like $700 or $795, something crazy like that, a lot of listeners have reached out to me to ask me my opinion. And by the way, thanks to you, listener. I'm like this big angry bear, and you guys are trying to poke me with a stick, trying to get me to comment or go on a rant. I know what you guys are up to. Don't worry. So look, you've poked the bear. I've woken up, and yes, I will comment. I've done a lot of reading on this Pink Floyd Early Years box set, the $700-and-something-dollar box set. And I got to tell you, I actually like this box set. I think it is quite a remarkable package, and I think diehard Pink Floyd fans are going to totally dig it. And here's why. First off, it's actually Pink Floyd. It's actually Roger Waters, Dave Gilmour, Nick Mason, Rick Wright, Sid Barrett, the folks that were around Pink Floyd and contributing to Pink Floyd. It's actually Pink Floyd. Whereas you look at the Roger Waters box set, Roger's like one out of 10 people on that stage, right? I mean, he's the only guy. 9 out of 10 people in a Roger Waters live concert were not in Pink Floyd. 90% of Roger Waters' The Wall Live is a cover band recreating, note for note, by the way, the entire Wall experience. Now, Roger Waters' The Wall experience was really meant to be visual, all right? I saw it. I saw it twice, in fact. It was remarkable live. Being in there, seeing the visuals, seeing it all come together was incredible. I think I paid $300 a ticket, so, you know, I expected it to be entertained, and I really wasn't disappointed. So I think Roger Waters Live really is a visual medium. It doesn't really translate to me anyway to record for $500, anywhere near that. Another reason I like this Pink Floyd box set, there's like 15 hours of restored video from that period of time, very early in Pink Floyd, before, you know, Dark Side of the Moon, when everyone started paying attention. It was really, really documented well. There's a lot of video and live performances and interviews from this whole era, stuff that diehard fans probably haven't seen, or at least haven't seen in decent quality. And all this stuff is cleaned up and remastered and, you know, preserved for future generations. So 15-plus hours of video, that's a lot of work for people that are cleaning up that stuff. So I think that was a huge effort, as well as the 7-plus hours of new audio. Now, I think this is a lot of demos, a lot of studio stuff, false takes, false starts, kind of like the Beatles anthology from what I could read. But again, incredible, and I'm sure it took a lot of effort for people to put all that together. It also comes with, I believe, a booklet and a bunch of 7-inch singles. Early in their career, Pink Floyd released all these singles, and really, to have those actual singles these days, especially in good condition, I'm sure will set you back hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars. So these are recreations of those singles, probably the closest that a lot of collectors will ever get to having the actual singles. So good on them for making these available. It all looks like a really cool package. It's $795, but you could find it right now on Amazon for less than $500. So all in all, I think the Pink Floyd Early Years box set is quite a cool deal. Now, the question is, am I going to buy one? Well, probably not right now. That takes a lot of time. That's a lot of effort. I am a big Pink Floyd fan, but I'm not sure I'm going to be able to have that sort of time to consume it or to truly appreciate it. However, I know that there's a heap of Pink Floyd fans out there that are just itching to get this, and this is probably what they're going to spend their holiday breaks on, just going over and over this treasure trove of Pink Floyd stuff. So yes, Pink Floyd the Early Years box set sounds awesome. I'm very curious about it. I'd love to take a look at it. I'd love to borrow one for a weekend and enjoy it. Not sure I'm going to be spending the $500 for it right now, but it would be a nice thing to have in a collection, especially if you're a big Floyd fan. All right, that's it for this episode of the Vinyl Guide Podcast. I want to thank everyone for their listenership. I really appreciate it. Always get lots of really kind notes and emails from you guys. You can always send me a note at Nate, N-A-T-E, at thevinylguide.com. Or you can join our Facebook page, facebook.com/vinylguide. We have all the episodes up there, plus more information, plus videos. So make sure you hop on our Facebook page or our website, www.thevinylguide.com. You could always leave us a positive iTunes review. That's a big help, by the way. If any of you guys want to do us a solid, you appreciate this podcast, you listen regularly, please hop on iTunes, leave us a 5-star positive review, say some nice things. That is always most, most welcome. Alrighty, well, we'll be back shortly with another episode. Until then, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.